please welcome Professor Richard Whitman.
Well, thank you very much, ladies and gents. I'm very touched that so many of you have such an interest in the travails of my small island nation. So thank you. I appreciate the support. So, Brexit. We've been living with the experience and the ongoing drama that is Brexit since the referendum in June 2016. It's had a significant impact on the UK in terms of occupying huge amounts of political bandwidth. It is socially and politically incredibly divisive and has really had an impact on the capacity of Britain to think and to act for its future. So what I want to do this evening is to talk a little bit about Brexit as it stands, you know, what's really behind what we've seen played out over the media over the last few months, and indeed last 3 years, to perhaps clarify for some people here what Brexit is all about. But I also have to declare that that during the referendum campaign, I was taken off my day job as an academic, and with a group of others, we were given the job of assisting the public and assisting media organisations in understanding EU issues as independent, dispassionate providers of expert advice to improve the quality of debate on the EU and the UK. So you can see that was a fantastic success. So you have to take whatever I say with a pinch of salt. But the referendum campaign is obviously, the campaign itself continues to have resonance because for many people it's seen as the first post-truth political campaign where lies were certainly told in the course of the campaign, where there are still question marks around the extent to which there was foreign intervention, particularly foreign money, and the degree to which the campaign was pursued in a way which allowed the public to really exercise their vote within the referendum in a meaningful way, because we had a restricted franchise. We also had a campaign where arguably the Remain campaign was closely directed by the government, and the Leave campaign had much more of an opportunity to be more gloves off. But I don't want us to talk about the campaign, but I'm happy to do so in the Q&A a little bit later. But obviously the result, which depending on how you read it, was either absolutely overwhelming to leave the EU or was so close that the UK needs to have another referendum. But in UK terms, it was a very, very high turnout. As you know, we don't have compulsory voting in the UK. And the question on the ballot paper was a clear question, which had been worked through by the electoral authorities in the UK. But what do we know about the Brexit vote as it took place? What do we know about what people thought about the issues when they voted? Well, it's clear, I think, and it's clearer by the day, that the Brexit issue is about, continues to be about, an ongoing civil war within the Conservative Party, a civil war which is not likely to end anytime soon. That was the trigger. But what we know from an analysis of the results and work that's been done to look at the attitudes of those who voted is it was clearly about issues of identity and alienation politics, that for many leavers, there was anxiety about a loss of Britishness, a loss of control over the ability of the British Parliament to make its own law, but also worries about issues like immigration, and really a concern in the area of economics about the UK losing out or individuals losing out as a consequence of globalisation. And I'll come back to this question of the public later, because I want to say something about whether the public might change its mind. So we know quite a lot about why people voted and the kind of issues that moved them when it took place. And of course, one of the consequences of the Brexit vote was that the UK got to change its Prime Minister, a Prime Minister who had gone into the referendum campaign on the basis of a pledge he'd made in the Conservative Party manifesto at an election, a general election, that the Conservative Party did not expect to win outright. So in terms of managing his own party or managing the civil war within his own party, David Cameron offered a referendum through the Tory Party manifesto, and what he got was to form a government and then have to negotiate with the EU on the terms of the UK's membership. And a great pub question for those of you involved in pub quizzes is, what were the terms that David Cameron negotiated on, and what was the deal that he got? Because it disappeared in the referendum campaign within 1 week as an issue of discussion, and other things took hold. Losing the vote, of course, the UK got a new prime minister, but it got a new prime minister who was untested, and the issue of Brexit itself and how Brexit should be interpreted was untested in the campaign to select Theresa May. We had a leadership contest in which Theresa May famously said Brexit means Brexit, but didn't have to elaborate on that because the other contenders for the leadership dropped away. But it also meant that what Brexit might mean wasn't properly rehearsed, even within the Conservative Party. And Theresa May then became Prime Minister, really on the back of an unclear prospectus. And what we've seen since is a sort of working through on the part of the Conservative Party as to what they understand by Brexit and what the costs and consequences are for the UK. But the Brexit process is highly unusual in international relations, because what we have is a country which is leaving an organisation, negotiating to leave that organisation, whilst at the same time remaining a member of that organisation. So we have the EU negotiating as a 27, the EU27, with the UK as a country. And what a lot of the Brexit story has been over the last few years is the UK learning to be a non-member state, what it means not to be a member of the European Union, but also for the EU learning what it means to negotiate with a country which has been a member, a long-standing member for decades, and how you untangle that relationship. And it's one of the reasons why the negotiations have been somewhat complicated. Now, we hear a lot of discussion about Article 50. And Article 50 is a pretty short text for something that has significant consequences. So this is the article that provides for a country leaving the European Union, and this is the basis on which the UK has been negotiating Brexit. And Article 50 says that basically any country can leave the European Union if it decides to do so on the basis of its own decision. It also says that the country that's going to leave has to let the EU know that it's going to leave, and that's what Theresa May did, or her government did, nearly 2 years ago. But the negotiations are all about the terms of leaving. And this is important because this often gets misunderstood in the debate about Brexit. It's all about the terms of leaving rather than the terms of the future relationship. In other words, this is about the so-called divorce rather than what the future might look like. And the real kicker in here is that Article 50 has a two-year duration. So once you trigger it, the clock runs, and at the end of that two-year period, if you do not reach a deal, then this country concerned leaves the European Union on a so-called no-deal basis. All the existing relationships with the EU drop away, and you have nothing else in place unless you've negotiated under Article 50 to clear up what the relationship might look like. You have nothing in place that determines what the future relationship might look like. The other thing about Article 50 is that the terms of withdrawing only have to be agreed by a majority of the EU member states. But actually what's remarkable about the negotiations is the degree of solidarity that the EU 27 have demonstrated. Now, you can extend the Article 50 period, and you can extend it, but on the basis of unanimity. So all EU member states have to agree. Okay? There's nothing in Article 50 that tells you over what duration you might extend it for, but all member states will have to agree. And for optimists in the room, if the country concerned wants to rejoin the EU, then they rejoin on the terms of the EU bargain at that time. So for the UK, if it leaves, and at some point in the future there is a decision on the part of the government or the electorate to rejoin, then it means membership of the single currency and membership of the Schengen Common Travel Area. So the British government or a future British government would not get back what it has now. Okay? So, that's Article 50. And Article 50 itself, and the approval of Article 50, has a kind of staged process. And we're at the point in time which a deal has been done, and I'll talk about the deal in a moment, but we're not yet at the stage of ratification. It's both sides have to ratify. The British government has to ratify, and the EU has to ratify. And part of the EU ratification is the member states. The other part is the European Parliament. No deal, in other words, no ratification, even if you've agreed a text, then no deal means you leave without anything in place. And again, we'll come back to that. What I want to talk about for the bulk of the time here is, if you like, the sort of Brexit difficulties. Is Brexit a mission impossible? Is Brexit actually going to happen? And I want to look in a number of areas that I hope will give a bit of an insight as to where we are on Brexit and what the likely outcomes might be. And I'm going to dance around that circle over the next little while. So the decision to invoke Article 50 was a decision that was taken by the British government, a decision that was taken by the Prime Minister. The government thought it could take that decision on its own. It was then adjudicated against in a case in the Supreme Court of the UK, which meant then it had to go to Parliament, and Parliament agreed to invoke Article 50. Which means that the process of starting those negotiations after a bit of a false start was approved by the British government, by the British Parliament, rather. But negotiating Brexit itself is actually a challenge of the order, of one which hasn't really been seen for the UK since the post-Second World War period. Because since membership in 1973, the UK has become connected socially, it's become connected economically, it's been connected politically, and also connected in terms of law and public administration. So the job of detaching is a pretty formidable undertaking, not just to detach, but to put other things in place. And part of the undertold story about Brexit is it's as much about negotiating to leave the EU, or the terms of what you leave, as it is putting in place alternatives for the UK. So all those things that you have as being an EU member, there are other things which are going to have to go in their place. And again, we could pick up on those in the discussion. But what the British government decided to do, you know, once the political decision had been taken to leave, once Parliament had taken the decision to leave, which is how do you make it work? What the British government has done is to arrange things in a way that I think is analogous to sort of hardware and software and computing, which is it's create the hardware, it's create dedicated departments for the purpose of negotiating or working through the detail of Brexit. And at the same time, there's obviously the software. You know, what are the ideas that run through it? What are you trying to achieve? Now, I think most of us have worked in organizations where you change the hardware, you get quite excited to have a new computer. You know, wonderful. You get a bit nervous when you change the software because you're a bit worried you might lose stuff or things might not work. You generally don't change the hardware and the software at the same time because that's a recipe for disaster. The British government's gone one stage further, which is to change the hardware and it's still writing the software. Yeah, it's still not sure or is still working through what it actually wants to achieve in the Brexit process. And it's also pursuing Brexit through a very tightly, centrally controlled process that the Prime Minister and her advisers have remained very central to the process itself. This has not been a process where the government has reached out. And for Mrs. May, part of the challenge has been negotiating with her own cabinet and with her own party rather than negotiating with the country and with the public as to what the desired Brexit actually is. And this is in many ways a rerun of the Iraq War experience, where the British government under Tony Blair decided to make a major order foreign policy decision, basically very tightly drawn in terms of those who were involved in taking that decision. And we know what the consequence was there. So you can see that the British are slow learners when it comes to major public policy challenges. Now, in doing Brexit or making Brexit work, I mentioned this new hardware. So the British government's put in place a system where the Prime Minister sits at the centre, and you've got, for the purpose of running Brexit, the creation of one new department and one sort of supporting department. And that's the Department for Exiting the EU, DexEU, which sounds like a laxative. Yeah. But that's exactly what it is, because the idea of DexEU is to purge the British public administration of things EU, right? But alongside that, you've created the Department for International Trade, because the UK, since it joined the EU in 1973, has not run its own trade policy. It's run its trade policy through the EU, as a customs union, through the EU's common commercial policy. So in leaving the EU, or setting out the infrastructure to facilitate leaving the EU, the British government's making a clear statement. You know, we're going to administer our exit from the EU, but at the same time, we're also going to build our new independent trade policy. We're going to have a new trade policy which is separate from the trade policy that we've run since 1973. So a very clear statement of intent there. But the curious thing, perhaps, is the Foreign Office, you know, the department that's really charged with the job of dealing with the outside world, has been pretty much sidelined in the process of negotiating Brexit, facilitated by our former Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, who was not a details man, I think it's fair to say. But also, Parliament has been sidelined in the process, and the government hasn't really sought to build a Brexit negotiating process that's involved Parliament or reaching out to Parliament. And really, those chickens are now coming home to roost as Parliament is trying to get much more of a say in the sort of end game of the negotiations. Also, absolutely crucially, and this is part of the problem of Britain's sort of constitutional plumbing, is that the devolved administrations, the governments in Scotland, Wales, and the administration in Northern Ireland, and the British overseas territories, places like Gibraltar, have not been plugged into the Brexit negotiating process. And I want to come back to that point a little bit later, because it means that essentially this is a process driven by a sort of Westminster and London view, rather than a view as to what's good for the UK, or what's a different held view, which is one that you find in Cardiff and in Edinburgh, where the administrations, they have different views about what kind of future relationship they want to see the UK have with the EU. So that's the hardware. The software problem, as I think we're all familiar with, is that Theresa May's problem has been she's found it very, very difficult to negotiate with the EU while simultaneously negotiating with her own party, dealing with challenges to her leadership, both on a no-confidence basis, but also those who are actively seeking to replace her. And having run a general election in 2017, where she lost the majority that she inherited and had to enter into an arrangement with the Democratic Unionist Party to supply the government with votes on key bills of government business. And that party, of course, being highly partisan in the Northern Ireland context and being the only party that didn't support the Good Friday Agreement, and one that stands for a particular constituency and a particular view as to Northern Ireland's place in relation to the rest of the UK and also in relation to the Irish Republic. And this has obviously been a major order challenge for her, I think, and also for the UK. But even with that, the government made life even more difficult for itself in its so-called red lines. And these were set out pretty early on when Theresa May became Prime Minister. And these red lines are what the government considered to be positions it would not move on. And they are, for sure, that the British government, or the Conservative government, wanted to leave the single market, wanted to leave the jurisdiction of the Court of Justice, leave the customs union so it can have its own independent trade policy, but also not have a border in Northern Ireland, which is incompatible with leaving the single market and leaving the customs union, which is one of the reasons why we have the backstop issue that I'll come back to, but also not to pay large financial contributions into the EU, but to be able to run an independent agricultural policy and a commons fisheries policy. As an approach to negotiations, it was a poor one, because, of course, what the British government was saying is, have a look at my cards. This is what I hold. These are the positions that I hold, and these are the ones that I'm not going to budge from. But alongside those red lines, there is also the other things that have to be squared as a consequence of Brexit. And this, I think, starts to pile up the Brexit complexity, because there is what's been called the Brexit six-pack. And the Brexit six-pack is the fact that it's not just about legally separating from the EU during Brexit. It's also that you have to build some kind of bridge between what you've got now as a member and what the future relationship will be, because most trade deals have an interim phase, have a provisional phase, have a phase that kicks in until they're fully ratified, so you need a bridge. What the future relationship is going to be, and we've got a pretty good idea of what that is, I'll come back to that a bit later, but it's a FTA, free trade agreement type relationship, but also cooperation on things like borders, border security, foreign policy, defence and so on. All of that is the stuff to sort out with the EU. But alongside that, as a consequence of deciding to have your own trade policy, is that the EU and the UK have had to enter into scheduled negotiations with the WTO as to what they do with quotas and other arrangements they have in common, because the UK is a member of the EU within the WTO, even though it's a separate member in and on its own right. And crucially, for the UK, its existing trade policy is the EU's trade policy, which means that the free trade agreements that Britain has with third countries are EU agreements, all of those needing to be replaced. And all of those needing to be replaced at the point in which you leave the EU. Now, this is recognised as a major order problem for people who deal with trade policy issues, but it barely has a blip on the public consciousness. Luckily, some governments overseas have a strong sense of what is potentially at stake. So the Australian government, for example, has signed the wine agreement with the UK. We're very grateful. Thank you very much. We'll continue to drink the good stuff, and a mutual recognition agreement. But most of the major free trade agreements that are in place between the UK and third countries through the EU are not yet in a position in which they've been replicated. In other words, no deal Brexit means not just a relationship with the EU that enters into uncertainty, but also with a significant number of third countries. So, the Brexit negotiations themselves, having made life pretty difficult for itself in the way that's approached the negotiations, having triggered Article 50 without really being clear about what the destination was for the British government, I think it's all the more remarkable it's actually been possible to reach a deal between the UK and the EU. But that deal has been reached in a way which has also stored up some problems for where we are now. The British government's position was it wanted to talk about the leaving issues alongside talking about the future relationship issues. Perfectly reasonable position to adopt, but not what's in Article 50. The EU said, no, we want to talk about the divorce issues, the leaving issues, before we will let you talk about the future relationship issues. And one of the major order problems we have now, the Brexit backstop issue, is an issue on which the British government and the EU was thought to have reached agreement back in December 2017, when a text was produced that said that the issues around the Irish border were ones in which they'd reached an understanding. And that, alongside issues to do with citizens and the financial settlement, unlocked talking about something called transition, which is how you move from where you are now to what the future relationship looks like. And I'll talk about that in a moment. So that's one of the reasons why, from the EU side, believing that it had that understanding penciled in, it feels now that the British government is reneging on what was a major commitment and has subsequently allowed the negotiations to move forward. Now, this diagram is sponsored by Specsavers. So I apologise. But what I wanted to do, and people can take a look at this after, I'm happy to email it to you, is it shows what the British government's red lines were, it shows what's in the withdrawal agreement that I'll talk about in a moment, and it shows where the British government basically had to move its position. In other words, the British government had to turn some of those red lines pink. And it had to turn them pink in pretty much every area. It was a realisation, as the negotiations unfolded, the complexity associated with the issues, and in particular, to avoid dislocation with the UK leaving the EU, the British government had to move on everything, with the exception of the issue of future trade policy, leaving the customs union and wanting to have its own trade policy. And again, I'll come back to that in a moment. And therefore, what Theresa May has done, this is perhaps an underappreciated achievement, is that she took a party, her party, and a government which didn't want to see those red lines moved, and she managed to get those shifted. She got them shifted on money. She got them shifted on the way in which the Court of Justice can adjudicate for quite a time after the UK leaves the EU on issues to do with citizenship. And therefore, really, she moved things quite a long way from where a party was certainly comfortable. And that is, I think, a major order achievement on her part. And as I say, one that I think is underappreciated. So what Parliament has been getting so exercised about at the moment, continues to be exercised about, is this so-called withdrawal agreement. And the withdrawal agreement doesn't appear to have been read by many British parliamentarians, if you follow what they say in Parliament and what they actually appear to believe is contained within the withdrawal agreement. It is all about settling the issues of leaving. So it's about how you settle what happens to citizens of both countries which are residing in one another's place. So UK nationals in other EU member states, EU nationals in the UK, how you treat each of them. It's about how you actually detach existing policy areas, because there's some stuff which will need detaching over a longer period. But absolutely crucially, it has something called the implementation period that I'll come back to. Deals with money, deals with Northern Ireland, and so on and so on. And I can talk about the different elements for any train spotters in the room. But the withdrawal agreement is probably best described as a hokey-pokey or hokey-cokey agreement. You're familiar with a hokey-pokey, hokey-cokey, depending on where you come from. One of the great things about the Anglosphere is I don't have to explain it. I can do it if you like. Often best done with a drink, I think, in your hand. So, you know, you put your right arm in, your right arm out, left arm in, left arm out. And at some point, you shake it all about. Now, the reason why I call it hokey-pokey agreement, because what the withdrawal agreement allows for is that when the UK is supposed to leave on the 29th of March, 2 years after triggering Article 50, the UK actually remains in the single market. It remains in the customs union. But it leaves all the EU's institutions. The UK remains in the EU policy universe. So for all intents and purposes, the EU remains a kind of zombie EU member state for a two-year period up until 2020, extendable out to 2022, that allows for the two sides to negotiate the future relationship, what the relationship should look like after. So it's a kind of bridge. As I say, it's called a transition phase. The shake it all about bit is Britain's allowed to start talking with third countries and negotiating on trade deals with third countries to replace those deals that it has with the EU. So the withdrawal agreement is a sensible way, as the government would see it, of managing the leaving from the UK, leaving the EU without having a cliff edge. So you put as much stability and certainty in place as possible, allowing you at the same time to say that you've left the EU and to negotiate out a future relationship. But within the withdrawal agreement, the thing which has become the sticking point is the so-called Northern Ireland backstop. And this is an insurance policy which says that if at the end of the transition period, if at the end of the period in which you've negotiated out with the UK and you can't reach an agreement, then for Northern Ireland, it remains aligned to the single market, and it remains, or the UK remains, in a customs union with the EU, which means that you don't have to have borders for customs checks. Okay? But it's the ultimate insurance policy. It only kicks in if you don't get a deal, and only kicks in if you can't find some way of managing that border relationship, which is different from the one that's envisaged in remaining with the single market, or alignment of the single market and with the customs union. Alongside the withdrawal agreement is something called the Political Declaration, and that sets out what the future relationship is. It's aspirational, how the EU and the UK should fit together. It's fantastic prose, but actually when you pick through it, it has very, very modest ambition. And the Political Declaration is the one that is easiest to amend, and actually could easily be amended by a future British government, which might take a different view as to what the relationship with the EU should actually be. So you've got withdrawal agreement and political declaration side by side. One of the reasons why the UK needs to have the withdrawal agreement in place and needs to have the transition agreement in place is because of who the UK trades with. Nearly half of UK trade is with the EU. And if you add on to that trade covered by trade agreements the EU has, you can see that nearly two-thirds of Britain's trade is in some way or other falls within the ambit and the structures of the European Union. If you have a no-deal Brexit, all of the terms on which the UK trades with the EU and with third countries, those then are put in jeopardy and disappear. It's like flicking a switch. And you have nothing in place that structures and organises that relationship. It's one of the reasons why a deal is so very important. But one of the reasons why the deal is so tricky is because what the British government is seeking to do is also to determine what the future relationship looks like. And the EU, in what is a sort of masterpiece of diplomatic trolling, is the Commission negotiating team, produced this diagram which shows the consequences of those red lines. So for the future relationship, if you don't want to be in the single market, you can't have a deal like the Norwegians. If you don't want free movement, if you don't want to make a substantial financial contribution into the EU, you can't have a deal like the Swiss. If you don't want to align with EU regulations, then you can't have a deal like the Ukrainians. And if you don't want to stay in the customs union, you can't have a deal like the Turks. So what would be open to the UK would be a deal like the Canadians or the South Koreans, or if you have no deal, then you trade on WTO terms. That's what would be left. This diagram, of course, is also sends a powerful signal that if you change your mind on any of your red lines, you can walk back up the steps. Yeah? There might be something different available to you from what currently appears to be what you're seeking. So that's what the government's done, that's what the government's put in place. But I think, as we're well aware, there is a bit of a sticking point, which is Westminster, and the Westminster the House of Commons in particular. And for Theresa May, obviously where she finds herself at the moment, is that having negotiated the agreement with the EU, bringing it back to Parliament, she's finding it difficult to get that agreement through Parliament. And what we know also is that the opposition, the Labour Party, doesn't really know what it wants from Brexit and has contorted itself to offer all sorts of things other than a clear prospectus as to what a Labour government or a Jeremy Corbyn-led Labour government might actually offer by way of a Brexit. So what do we know in terms of Parliament and where Parliament might end up? This is one of the exciting things, I think, about Brexit. That's classic British understatement, by the way. That what we do know from the last couple of days is that there is no appetite in the UK Parliament for Theresa May's deal at the moment, this week. Come back to that in a moment. What we also know is that there's no appetite for a no deal. So British parliamentarians are clear about what they don't want, or appear to be clear about what they don't want, is they don't want the existing withdrawal agreement, including the Irish backstop, but they also don't want to leave on no deal terms because that would be catastrophic for Britain's economy. And so we are likely to see the consequences of those views work through over the next week, and I'll come back to those at the end. But what do the public want? So it's one thing to be clear that Parliament is still working through what it wants. What about the public? Well, if you take a look at public opinion, particularly on the idea of a second referendum. Do people want a second say? It's clear if you look at polls, and this shows all of the polls that have been taken asking people the question about how they would vote if you have a second referendum, and tracked across time, you can see that remaining in the EU leads by a very, very small margin, but leaving the EU is within touching distance of remaining. In other words, there hasn't been a great shift in public sentiment on the issue of having a second referendum to have a second say on whether to leave or to remain. It's basically within the margin of error. And in fact, the result, if you ran the same referendum on the same question, on the same franchise, it would probably be those who didn't vote last time who would determine the outcome. So, you know, for anybody who takes the view that, you know, maybe the second referendum is salvation for the UK, I'm sorry to disappoint you. And part of the reason for that is that the things we know about the way people voted haven't shifted. Because over the last 3 years, the British government's basically been focusing on Brexit and not dealing with some of the deep-seated problems that you have in the UK. If you look at the breakdown of the Leave vote, it's very striking, the level of educational attainment for those who voted to leave. That essentially, you can almost work out who might be a Leave voter on the basis of at what point they left formal education. Ditto with income. You can see also in terms of housing tenure, whether people own their own house and so on. So essentially, you know, those people who are the most vulnerable, the most lost, the most disadvantaged in British society, all of those who sort of need major public policy intervention to try and change their circumstances, they've had nothing from the government over the last 3 years. So why would you shift your view? Why would you shift your opinion? So I think that's one possible explanation. Now, we also have... and this has tended to be overshadowed by Brexit. We also have what I call the two-union problem. We have the UK's relationship with the European Union, but we also have the Union of the United Kingdom problem. And as you'll be well aware, there was a referendum on Scottish independence, which didn't succeed in getting independence for Scotland. But if you look at Brexit and the Brexit vote, there were differential views on Brexit expressed in the referendum in Scotland and in Northern Ireland. Wales was much closer to England. Where this is of significance is having the government in Scotland, but also in a population in Northern Ireland, which seeks a different kind of Brexit, and in the case of the Scottish government, actively argues for a different kind of Brexit from the one that the British government is pursuing. And the question is whether exiting on the terms of which the British government is looking to exit then has the consequences of triggering more independence interest within Scotland and so-called border poll or cross-border poll in Northern Ireland. So, 15 days to go until you have the end of the Article 50 process. Remember that two-year time-limited process. So, is it going to be a deal or is it going to be no deal? This is the bit where I'm going to stick my neck out. Now, a deal is that under the terms of Article 50, the withdrawal agreement that's going through Parliament gets through Parliament, and in the last few hours, Theresa May has announced that she's going to have another meaningful vote next week. Now, the meaningful votes, these are not legislative votes. You'd still have to have another vote on the legislation that would allow for the withdrawal agreement, but it gives us a pretty good idea of where Parliament is moving and thinking. And I would put money on that vote, if it happens next week, being much closer than where it was this week. I'm happy to explain why that's the case in the Q&A, if you're interested. But if you don't get the withdrawal agreement in place, then you have a no-deal scenario, which means that there is the dislocation in trade and travel between the UK and the EU, and that any future relationship between the EU and the UK, all of those withdrawal agreement issues will still be live issues. They'll still have to be sorted out one way or another, either through future negotiations or through adjudication. All of those will have to be settled outside the Article 50 process. But it looks like we're going to get some kind of fudge in the short term, which is to stop the clock, to extend the Article 50 period, most likely out till June, because that's the least complicated period to extend it for, because it doesn't impinge on the European Parliament elections, which are coming down the road. But for what purpose? Because the Article 50 extension is there to be decided by the EU, not the UK. The British government can ask for it, and we'll get the vote this evening in the UK on whether that will be asked for, or whether Parliament is minded to ask the government to do that. But what's it for? What's the extension for? Is it just to try and get the deal through? To try and get the existing deal through? That's really the only realistic reason for having that extension. Or you need a much longer extension, basically, for the British government to go back to Brussels and say, we want to completely rework the withdrawal agreement because we've decided to change our red lines. So say, what I think we'll see next week is that meaningful vote 3 possibly getting through. If not, we might even get meaningful vote 4. All of those happening just in advance of the European Council. That's the meeting of heads of state and government, which happens on the 20th and the 21st. So I'll leave things there, if I may, but I'm very happy to take your questions and comments. Thank you very much.
Professor Whitlam, if there is no deal and the UK leaves the EU, do they have to pay the divorce agreement?
Great question. I think the answer is maybe. The sum of money that's been decided that the UK has to pay is in the region of £38 billion. Which is intended to cover all of the obligations that the British government has on the basis of decisions that the EU has taken, but it could end up being more because there are legacy payments, for example, on things like pensions. So the final reckoning will probably take quite some time. If there is no deal, then the EU's view would be that those obligations are still there on the part of the British government, and therefore they have to be paid in one way or another. And so I think whatever happens in the future relationship, the money question is going to be there. And it will be a question of, you know, how the money is tied to what kind of a deal that you actually get. I mean, it's a very, very large sum of money. And as you recall, the key issue within the referendum campaign, or a key theme, was the idea that money that was going to the EU could be paid or used, for public expenditure and other things like the health service. But it's interesting how the money issue has disappeared, actually, in the Brexit discussion in the UK. It's something that's been pushed to the margin rather than something that's front and centre.
Thank you very much for an incredibly lucid and clear exposition of the situation. Reading through the terms of the article, it looked to me as if there was absolutely no option for the British government to say, sorry, we made a great mistake, let's forget about all that, let's revert to the status quo. Yeah. Is that right? Is that not an option?
It is possible to revoke Article 50, and there's been a case that went through the European Court of Justice to basically work through whether it's possible to do it or not. However, there isn't a majority in Parliament to revoke Article 50 at the moment. Now, we couldn't rule out the idea that you might have a different Parliament that might decide to do so, but you can't have a general election between now and the end of March. It might be possible to have a general election between now and an extension to the Article 50 period. But it is something that I think is possible, but unlikely, frankly. And I think also on the part of the EU member states, I think one of the things that's changed really over the last 5 to 6 months is that whereas other member states had held out for the idea that the UK may remain a member, I think that patience has obviously worn pretty thin. And the costs of continuing to deal with the Brexit issue are such that even the UK's sort of historic close partners, like the Netherlands, basically come round to the view that Britain is leaving and should leave on the least damaging terms. I mean, the other thing perhaps to say about Article 50, one of the reasons why I think the EU will have an interest in extending it is not because it wants to do the British government any favours, but so it can put no deal preparations in place. Because again, I mean, the preparations on the EU side, the EU member state side, have only really just got going. And I think they would want a bit more time to try and mitigate the damage that would come as a consequence of a no deal scenario, a sort of what I call a managed no deal. I mean, managed no deal makes it sound perhaps less chaotic than it actually would be, but it's an interest that the EU now has and now actively working towards in terms of passing legislation to sort of prepare for that no deal scenario.
Thank you, an excellent overview that scares us all. There's lots of questions I'd love to ask, and thank you for going through such a brilliant overview of the process. Could you walk to the opposition? Because there's the view that somehow Corbyn will not go for it. I mean, he doesn't really want it to work, but he is obliged to at least try for the people's vote through the Labour Party arrangement. I mean, I can't work out what on earth he will do there, but his party seems to be breaking apart under him. And the damage done will be the future destruction of the Labour Party, I think.
I mean, the Labour Party is interesting because, as you know, there are a very small number of Labour MPs who voted with the government with the government on the withdrawal agreement. But it's also a minority of Labour MPs who have publicly supported the idea of a second referendum. It's not a majority view held within the Labour Party. You know, the leadership has now offered the idea of having a second referendum, but it doesn't enjoy universal support within the parliamentary Labour Party. And therefore, Labour is in this kind of double bind. The Labour Party is cleaved, where essentially most members of Parliament probably want to remain, but they don't necessarily want a second referendum. But they're also at odds with the Corbyn leadership for all sorts of reasons. Corbyn himself is clearly a leaver. And his front bench team, when they talk on Brexit, are trying to cover a range of possibilities for the UK which are not realistic. For example, a particular kind of customs union and single market relationship, which is one that doesn't exist. I mean, for me, the interesting question would be if we see that Theresa May goes to meaningful vote 3, meaningful vote 4, you have the European Council next week, and her deal really is deader than dead, and then feeling that there has to be a general election, there is a feeling there has to be a general election to clear the way. I think that's the pathway to another referendum. There's quite a lot that has to happen between now and then. And actually what should have happened in the general election in 2017 is the party should have offered very clear alternative visions of what Brexit was. Whereas both of the two main parties basically said, we accept Article 50, we accept that the UK is leaving. But the Labour Party didn't really set out a clear alternative prospectus for what kind of relationship might exist. And probably where the Labour Party is at is some kind of European Economic Area type relationship with customs union membership. But the Corbyn leadership appears to have some difficulties in understanding what bits of EU policy actually mean, like competition policy, for example. So I think there is a general problem across Parliament, backbench and frontbench, in understanding what the EU is, what the EU does, and what the UK's obligations are already as a member, and therefore not being in a good position to be able to assess what the alternatives might be to membership, which would be good for the UK and good in squaring where sort of public sentiment is, what the vote is, and what you could realistically get through Parliament in the short term. But I think everything, not everything changes, but things could change quite significantly with the general election.
Can I just ask, what's your view on the recent statement by Jacob Rees-Mogg of the European Research Group, which said something like, the problem we've got is that the British Parliament, the majority of MPs in the British Parliament, wish to remain, and Theresa May, of course, was a Remainer, and the British people have voted to leave. And thus, there's this massive conflict between Parliament trying to pull one way and the British people have voted to leave.
Yeah. I think the UK's learned quite a lot about referendums and how you manage a referendum result. Because, you know, what Britain really needed was basically a public conversation after the first referendum result as to what the outcome should be in the negotiations. What we've got locked into is a leave-remain groove, where people are largely defined in terms of how they voted in the first referendum, rather than trying to find some sort of bridging position, something that's the outcome, of a process that people could sign up to. And as a consequence of that, I think we constantly get these battles refought, particularly in Parliament. I think it's a problem within Parliament, perhaps less so outside of Parliament. And the referendum mandate, of course, was not one for a particular kind of Brexit. It was to leave, fair enough, but what do you leave to move into? And that's really where I think Parliament has the greatest difficulties in working through what that means. There are clearly members of Parliament who want to remain, and we've seen Tory members of Parliament defect into this new independent group within Parliament, and members of the Labour Parliamentary Party also defect. But the interesting thing, if you look at pollings, is that the centre ground is not really represented by anybody. But what we also know about political culture in the UK is that people's first order identities now are essentially leave or remain. They're not identifying with political parties. That's a really big problem for Britain's political parties, because you don't really map onto the public any longer. So it'll be interesting to see what happens when we do have a general election, and how things actually fall. But I think one of the most damaging things about this whole exercise is that we've needed to shift on the language, and it's been impossible to shift on the language to have a proper grown-up conversation, Frank.
Thank you. You mentioned at the start of your talk that you would be happy to answer some questions about the campaign towards Brexit. You described it yourself as a post-truth campaign. I just wanted to unpack that. To what extent was the Brexit campaign effectively conveyed and maybe clearly conveyed to the British public?
I think there were different levels of the campaign, and one of the best accounts of the sort of central organisation and sort of politics of the campaign is Tim Shipman's book, All Out War. He's a Times journalist, does a really good job of really conveying how the Remain campaign sort of tied both arms behind its back and was essentially directed by Tan Downing Street to run a particular kind of Remain campaign, whereas the Leave campaign was absolutely brilliant in the way that it worked out messages which had a high degree of resonance with people, and very assiduously avoided the question of, so what is the alternative future if you don't remain as a member? And I think that was obviously very successful and was the winning strategy at the end. However, you know, standing behind that is the fact that it's clear, and you know, I saw this on the campaign trail, that the Remain campaign was just inept at grassroots campaigning. It was inept because the Labour Party was pretty much uninterested in campaigning alongside Tories at the grassroots level, but also at things like speaking events, you know, debate events. And generally, the Remain campaign would put up somebody like a retired diplomat. I mean, my apologies for anybody who's a retired diplomat, but they don't necessarily have resonance in a public context. I mean, not least because they don't like, you know, doing politics, frankly, and are not necessarily geared up to be campaigners. And their talking points were always the same points over and over again, whereas the Leave campaign were much more connected, frankly, and could find ways that had resonance with the audience, you know, touched on local issues. But also, and this is very different from the 1975 referendum that we had in the UK, again, the same thing, a referendum after renegotiated terms, was that the business groups were largely uninterested in being heavily involved in the campaign. I mean, they stood to one side. British Chambers of Commerce, for example, didn't argue for one particular side. They just put out information about what the surveys of their members said. The CBI ran a very sort of lukewarm campaign. So if you were looking for those constituencies to offer perhaps something that had a little bit more meat in terms of offering what the consequences might be, they weren't there. So I think, I mean, the long and short of it is, it was, for the Remain, the worst possible way to run a campaign. But there are obviously issues that we're only now waking up to as to the role of social media and how that may have had an impact on voters' intentions. We're uncovering more and more about money and where money may have come from. That's not entirely clear. But the difficult thing for the UK is because we're still in the middle of the Brexit process, the post-mortem about the campaign, the money, the issues around veracity when it came to campaign, none of those things can be sort of effectively raked over and appropriate lessons drawn. So again, that's one of the reasons I would be nervous about the prospect of having another referendum in the UK until Britain had thought quite hard about how you prepare for a referendum and how you deal with the consequences of a referendum. You know, we're still in the nursery, I think, in the UK, in thinking about the use of referendum as a tool, and the Brexit referendum essentially was a weaponization of the public in this civil war within the Conservative Party, and so for those members of the Conservative Party who were involved, who were obviously prominent Leave campaigners, their motives were not entirely driven by a clear belief and understanding as to what the UK's best interests were in the future relationship with the EU.
Thank you very much, Professor Whitman, for the talk and your graphics up there. Just to be clear to start, is the UK the only nation in the European Union that didn't join the monetary union? There are other nations.
There are member states. There are those who have an opt out, like Denmark. Those who have decided to not to join when they should do, like Sweden. But there are also other member states who haven't yet qualified, Central and Eastern European states, who haven't yet met the thresholds for joining the monetary union. So, but the UK and Denmark were the only two countries who negotiated an opt-out.
So historical question and hypothetical. Can you just give why UK? I would imagine UK would have qualified to join the monetary union. Yeah. So why didn't they? And hypothetical, do you think if they had have joined, the referendum would have never happened, or what might have happened from there?
I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult to imagine the circumstances in which Britain would have joined the monetary union, would have signed up to the single currency. For a couple of reasons. One is that the sort of precursor arrangement for single currency membership, the exchange rate mechanism, is something that the British government, the UK got kicked out of really as a part, consequence of market speculation. And that was something that, in effect, cost the Conservative Party its role as the governing party in the UK from 1997 until the Cameron government came into power. Second reason is the Labour Party, which then took over from the Tories, set up a number of tests that would have to be satisfied before a British government would contemplate joining the single currency. And by the way, there would have been a referendum on single currency membership, which I don't think would have got through. But those tests were also structured in such a way that the question would never have arisen, I think, that the British government would seek to join the single currency. And there's reasons for that, which are to do with the sort of British ambivalence about European integration, but also to do with sterling and the role of the City of London. And those are all reasons why I think that British governments have not taken the view that it would be something that would be in the UK's interest.
Professor Whitman, very enjoyable presentation, and I would very much like it if you would join us for dinner, because I've got more than one question. Just so you know who I am, I stood for the British Parliament in 1996 for the referendum party, so I have my own views on who saved Britain from the euro. Now, there is a view going around at the moment that the withdrawal agreement was written in Germany with Merkel and May. The word Quisling springs to mind. Article 50 states quite clearly that in the negotiations there should be discussions of the free trade agreement. There have been none. In other words, the EU, as usual, is breaking its own rules. The political declaration, which you mentioned, is hardly being discussed at all, and it is the prototype for how the European Union will treat us if we remain. We could start with fishing, which quite clearly states that fishing will be entirely dictated in our waters by the European Union. The civil service, from insiders, are being accused of being 90% Remainers, egged on by people like Hammond. So that doesn't sound very good. I actually think we may fall out, and it'll be absolutely terrific. Britain, and I'm a POM, is a terrific nation with fantastic talents, and I believe we will be fantastically successful. And who's going to be the next Prime Minister? I can't find anyone to give me the odds, but I want to put my money on Nigel Farage, first past the post.
I mean, there's. I think some of those issues would definitely bring on indigestion, but I think what's clear about the structure of the negotiations again. You know, this is I've just written a piece which has been published for Chatham House in the UK, and it's Journal International Affairs, which I think is available publicly, which looks at sort of Britain's place in Europe after Brexit, Britain's European diplomatic strategy. And it's clear to my mind that, you know, I mean, Britain is a European power, will remain a European power. The question for Britain is obviously going to be, you know, how it wants to involve itself and for what purposes. And at the same time, the European Union is going to be a major order concern for the UK, because in the short term it's going to be its most important market, but also the sort of health and vitality of the EU will be of interest to the UK in terms of its own security, which is not the same thing as saying, you know, that the UK wants to be a member or a part of that, but a sort of unstable EU is bad for the UK. But at the same time, I think the UK has learned what it's like to be a third country negotiating with the EU. And that is clearly a very, very uncomfortable experience. I mean, not least because one of the most effective things that the EU does is to create a firewall between the member states and the third party it's negotiating with through the European Commission. And Britain's found it pretty difficult to get what it wants through national capitals. Saying all of that, when it comes to the negotiations on the future relationship, those will work in a slightly different way, because they're obviously the in individual national capitals, there are different interests from what we've seen come through in the divorce negotiations. It's very easy to agree on things like money collectively on the part of the member states as to what they might want to see paid up. But it's also quite different then to see what kind of relationship you might want to have with the UK on an issue like fishing, for example, where some member states have a view. And that's one of the reasons why the backstop is of concern for parliamentarians, for reasons I fully understand, because clearly there, if you are locked into a relationship with the EU, then that may be one that then determines or over-determines how you treat some other issues, like issues of natural resources, like fishing and so on. So I think Brexit has a long way still to go. We're only in the foothills of the Brexit process. Cheer everybody up. But also at the same time, for me, the really interesting, again, under-discussed question, which is you alluded to, is a kind of black swan. You know, what happens, Britain makes a success of Brexit, however we measure success, or the cost is not too high for the UK, and then it presents an alternative model for other European states. You know, Britain's going against the grain by leaving the EU, whereas most other European states have signed up to the EU. What will be the role or function of Britain? What will Britain look like in an EU which has a whole series of problems that it has to come to terms with, many of which have really been sort of papered over or covered up while the Brexit debate's going on? So I'm happy to come back and talk about the success or failure that Britain makes of Brexit.
How did you vote?
How did I vote in the cabinet? Yeah, it is an impossible question.
Did you vote?
Did I vote? I did vote. I voted. Yeah. I voted with a postal vote. Okay. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.